Institute of Politics. My name is Emily, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. Today's guest is Ambassador George Zappari. He became Ambassador of Hungary to the United States on February 23, 2011. Ambassador Zappari previously served as Deputy Governor of the National Bank of Hungary and a member of the Monetary Council on two occasions, as well as advisor to the President of the National Bank of Hungary and Senior Resident Representative of the International Monetary Fund in Hungary. Prior to that, he worked at the IMF in Washington, D.C., most recently as Assistant Director from 1966 to 1993. He also has held a number of other positions, which include Alternate Governor for the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, President of the Board of Directors for the International Training Center for Bankers in Budapest, Board Member of the Budapest Commodity Exchange, Member of the Economic and Financial Committee of the European Commission and of the European Central Bank's International Relations Committee, and member of the Hungarian Economic Social Council. Ambassador Zappari has also been a member of the Advisory Council for the European Studies Foundation in Budapest since 2002. He holds a master's degree and a doctorate in economics from the University of Leuven in Belgium, where he was also a research assistant in the early 1960s. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador Zappari.
I'm just trying. Okay. Well, good morning, everybody. As you could hear from the introduction, I'm by training an ambassador, an economist. And so I thought I would talk to you about the current economic situation, which is very much influenced by the crisis that we started in 2008. And ever since, you know, we are facing this problem. So what I thought was that I would a little bit show you how this crisis started and how the governments and central banks have dealt with it. And then I will also talk about the impact of the crisis on the Central and Eastern European countries from the region where I am from. And then I will, you know, answer questions. So what was special about this crisis was in 2008 that when it started, you only saw the tip of the iceberg. This is why you have this picture here. And as the crisis developed, you realized, the people realized, that actually the problem was much bigger. It started out as a financial crisis. You might have heard about the subprime crisis, too many bad loans, mostly to the households. So banks started to have problems, couldn't pay back their loans. But then it became a debt crisis as the governments tried to bailed out the banks. By bailing out the banks, they increased the debt of the government. And the debt crisis then became a confidence crisis because people didn't know how where this whole situation will lead to, and then it impacted growth. And, you know, it's an iterative process. if there's a growth crisis, there's also a confidence crisis. The growth crisis means that unemployment increases. People are, those who work, they are not sure whether they can keep their employment. So it becomes a confidence crisis. I mean, if it becomes a confidence crisis, then it's also a growth crisis because people don't spend the money. Even those people who have the pocket to spend money, they don't spend the money because they don't know what the future holds. So what is special about this crisis is this started out as a financial crisis, and it bent over and it became both a growth and a confidence crisis. just to show the indebtedness here of the various areas, look at the Eurozone. As you could see, the debt has very much increased from the from the time the crisis started, which is really the fall or the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, a big investment bank. Then, you know, you could immediately see that the public debt, the red line, started to increase. This and the same thing in the United States. What is interesting in the case of the United States, that as the public debt increased, the private debt started to decline for a number of reasons, because first of all, the people who had large debts, they started to repay the debt, and also the however, the same thing in Europe has happened a little bit less. But the point of this chart is that as a result of the financial crisis, public debt has increased very much. And for instance, in the United States, the public sector debt increased to over 100%, or around 100%, which was very large. As you could see, prior to the crisis, it was around 60%. So it's a very, very rapid increase in a short period of time, and the same thing in the Eurozone. If you look at this, it shows the impact that it had on growth, real GDP. As you can see, in each, both in the Eurozone, in the United States here, and in the Eurozone, there was a big decline in the in the GDP, and it started to increase, come back to the level prior to the crisis, only, you know, 2012, 2013. So it took about 2 to 4 years to just get back where you were. Now, what was the response? How did the various authorities? Look at the central banks. The central banks reacted immediately, reducing very much the interest rates. As you can see, the Fed interest rates were very rapidly reduced and hovering around zero, between 0 and 0.25. So that was a spontaneous reaction when you saw that the GDP started to decline. That was still, a classical orthodox approach to central banking. What you do is when growth is declining, unemployment is increasing, you reduce interest rates. However, it turned out, as you could see, the problem bigger and bigger, the indebtedness problem and the confidence crisis, the central bank started to do very unorthodox things. What they did was they started, in the United States, they started to buy government bonds, but also a little bit of agency bonds, a little bit of even enterprise bonds. And the result of that was that, as you can see, up in the these are the assets. As you can see, that the balance sheet of the Fed has very much increased due to the purchases of bonds or mortgage-backed securities. However, the bank did that in the hope that this money would enter the economy, people would begin to spend, invest and spend, etc. However, that didn't happen. What happened was that this money injected into the economy found its way back to the central bank, to the Fed, as deposits of commercial banks. That's what you see below the line on the liability side. Why? Because, again, demand didn't pick up, partly because everybody was deleveraging. People with large debt, they were deleveraging, paying back the debt, because there wasn't sure whether they can keep their employment or what the future holds. So rather than spending money or even borrowing money, they started to pay down the debt. I just go very quickly through. The Bank of England did the same thing. The Bank of Japan did the same thing. It's very, very similar. The European Central Bank did a little bit differently. It didn't buy so much. Government bonds. It mostly what we call long-term repo operations. In other words, they gave long-term credit out, because typically central banks do the banks that give short-term credit. But again, you know, on the asset side it increased, and then correspondingly on the liability side. So what that really meant, let me first say, so how much money was injected by all these major central banks? It shows that it was roughly equal to 16% of their total GDP. It's an enormous injection of liquidity money into the economy. And here what you see, despite of this, the GDP growth was relatively low. As you can see, you know, 100 was the pre-crisis, and it remained in most countries, you know, just around or a little bit higher, except the United States. The United States has been growing much faster, you know, 2.5%. It's not enough to absorb all the unemployment, so the United States should grow a little bit faster. But still, the United States did much better than the Eurozone or Japan. And particularly the Eurozone, if you see it, the blue line, actually the Eurozone has picked up a little bit, but it's sort of even a little bit declining. It's not increasing very fast. Unemployment rate has, again, it's in the United States that is declining the fastest, because it's growing the fastest. And in the Eurozone, the blue line, is actually increasing. In some of the countries like Spain, it exceeds 20%, which is very large. And then youth unemployment is even larger than that. So one can ask, well, why is it that the United States is doing much better than Europe? Well, one reason is this. The United States is like a big aircraft carrier with one captain. The Eurozone and the European Union is 28 different destroyers. And it's much easier when you have just one captain where you want to go, when you have 28 destroyers, 28 captains, and you have to tell them where you go. And there's every time somebody that wants to go to the different direction. That's one of the reasons. But there are a number of other reasons. Of course, the United States is uniquely placed to have to come out from this crisis. First of all, it has a younger population, thanks to the immigration to a large extent. Europe has an aging population. It's one of the things. The social benefits are much more widespread or larger in Europe than in the United States, and on top of it, with an aging population, that's a big burden on the budget. Also, the United States is at the edge of invention, high technology, and so forth, and that is also helping the United States compared to the Europe, and also the United States are much more natural resources. So all this together makes it that the United States is uniquely better prepared to get out of this crisis than Europe. Now, I come to the Central and Eastern European countries, our region, and what you can see here that I have grouped in sort of two groups, the ones that are doing a little bit better than the others that are not doing as well. There you have, on this side, you have the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, Slovakia, and Romania. What you can see there, that the best is the Poland. Poland is doing Poland and Romania for doing better. The Poland is relatively come out of that crisis relatively well, because it's a large country. It's almost as large, or as large as France population-wise. Secondly, they can live on the domestic market much more than smaller countries that are export-driven, and since a very large part of the exports, anywhere between 75 and 80% of the exports go to the European Union, within the European Union, mostly to Germany, and since Germany hasn't been doing very well, not grown very fast, at 1% around the world, they were much more affected by the decline in exports or the slowing down in exports than Poland, who has a very large domestic market and could grow on the basis of domestic demand. And then here are the other countries, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Slovenia, Bulgaria, that they've been more affected. And as you can see, everybody had a big decline in GDP growth. But as you can see, these countries, this group of countries, in 2013, some of them are not even back where they were in 2008, and the others are just above, just a little bit above. So that shows the extent of the crisis. And if you look at unemployment rates, it's in these countries is very high. On the left-hand side, it hovers, it goes up to 15% even, but some of the countries are only around 5%. But at this side, among these countries, whereas I mentioned the recovery was much slower, you are in the 15%, your double-digit inflation, unemployment rate. You also have in these countries as well rising public debt. As you can see, in most of the countries, the public debt has increased. Here, the largest debt is Hungary, 80%, because there was a period between 2002 and 2010 where the government deficit was very high, hovering around 7 and 9% or so. So the debt increased very much, and it is just sort of leveling off, 80%. The other countries are are much less. But still, what you can see is that in these countries also public debt has increased. And if everybody is deleveraging, the private sector is deleveraging, the governments are deleveraging because they want to reduce the debt, then there is no domestic demand. And if there is no domestic demand, there is no growth. So that's the short conclusion of this crisis. Now, the future of the CE, Central and Eastern European region. I think that region will grow faster than the mature Western European economies. The reason is very simple, because the possibility to increase productivity is much bigger in those countries, because the level of productivity is relatively low. However, you can import all the technology. You can get all the technology. So there is room to increase the productivity. At the same time, the labor is still relatively cheap. It's getting more and more expensive, but it's relatively cheap. And it depends very much, of course, on how
the export market of these countries will do. And as I said, it's mostly Germany and the rest of Western Europe. So it's tied a little bit to the recovery of these countries as well. But it's it does attract investment, foreign direct investment, both from Western Europe and also from the United States, Japan, even China. And that will increase the production base and the productivity of in these countries, and therefore they will have the possibility to grow, and at the end of the road to catch up with the average development level of of the more mature European economies. I mentioned something about the regional cooperation of the Visegrad 4 group. These are four countries, Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary, and Slovakia, and they are called the Visegrad group because Visegrad is a city in Hungary where, where it's an old royal royal city, and they met there and they agreed among themselves to cooperate. And that cooperation is economic cooperation, and trying to take the same position on certain political or international political issues, and like in the case of Ukraine, for instance. And that also helps these countries' economic development, this type of cooperation. Let me say a few words about the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership that is called TTIP. This is a very big undertaking. It's the goal is to have a free trade agreement between the United States and the EU. But if it's not just for trade, it's also for services and also for harmonizing regulations. So it would be a very, very big step forward. There is a very large commitment on the part of this administration and also in Europe. However, you know, the devil is in the details. So now they've started to negotiate in earnest on different issues and, you know, various problems prop up, and you know you have to sort this out. But everybody is very helpful that in 2 years it may be finished, and then it would have a big impact on both the United States and the European economies. And let me show here what type of the estimates are of what type of impact it will have. For instance, it says that in the United States it would increase by about 750,000 jobs, the employment. Or trade would increase in the United States by about 32% to the EU. But I'll show you another chart, which is for Utah. Interestingly enough, when I was looking at this chart, I discovered that it's Utah where the share of EU in the state's exports are the highest, 37%. You know, the dark the dark states are the ones where there is the highest, you know, between so a little bit over 30%. But as I was looking at the map, I found out that 37 is the largest share. So as a result of that, it means that the free trade agreement would particularly benefit Utah because of the share of the EU is very high. And then here it shows an estimate of the estimated increase of Utah exports to EU with TTIP would be 65% almost, and employment effect is about 7,000 jobs on a yearly basis. I presume, I'm not 100% sure how they calculated it, but it was interesting for me to find out that Utah is the one that would benefit the most from the TTIP. Now, this is something that has been done from every state, and I looked it up, Utah, and then I found these statistics, which I found were very interesting. Now, I would stop here. I was said that I can talk of 25 minutes. It's 23 minutes now, and I'm ready to answer questions. Thank you very much for your attention.
Good afternoon. My name is Josh Greep. Thanks for coming out today. I'm a pre-social work major. I have a question. I was listening to NPR this morning, and they were talking and they were discussing, they were mentioning that as employment rates increase, so the unemployment rate decreases, that interest rates should start to increase on loans and other things. What's the correlation there, and why should that be? Is that true? And what do you have to say about that?
Yes. Let me start this. Monetary policy has an impact with a lag. What you do today to interest rates, it will have in the United States maybe a year and a half or even 2 years impact on the economy. So if unemployment is decreasing, it means that demand is picking up, okay? And if you do not control the pickup of demand, you can get high growth but very high inflation also. So you want to keep that under control. So basically the worry is that maybe down the road inflationary pressures will come. And since since the impact of the monetary policy comes with a lag, you have to think ahead of time. And so the debate is, well, what is the level of unemployment rate where you begin to increase interest rates? Now, what has happened in the Fed, as I said, they have been injecting liquidity to buying treasury bills and bonds at the tune of $85 billion per month. And what they have decided is to reduce that a little bit, what is called the tapering. What the Fed has been saying is that you first start to reduce the liquidity injection before you actually increase interest rates. So the debate is now around that, how fast to reduce the purchases of government bonds, and then of course when is the time to increase interest rates. And Fed has adopted a so-called forward guidance, where they sort of tell ahead of time of when they think there would be time to take some measures like increasing interest rates. And they would, at the beginning they said that, you know, once unemployment reaches 6.5%, maybe this is the time. Now they're looking at maybe when it is reduced to 6%. You know, so that's how now you're doing.
Yeah, my name is Gergay. Thank you for your presentation. One question, which is kind of twofold. Talking for a second about Hungary, which Hungary is not part of the Eurozone at this point, has its own original currency. But for a long time, it was an immediate plan to introduce the euro into Hungary as well, similar to a handful of other Eastern Central European nations. Now, my question is regards the fairly spectacular economic comeback of Hungary in the past 3 or 4 years. Most of those results that Hungary has achieved were got possible through so-called unorthodox economic measures. So if you don't mind, just for the audience to describe very briefly what type of measures those unorthodox ideas were, number one. Number two, Would these results have been possible for Hungary if it was already in the Eurozone?
Well, what Hungary has done was decided, of course, to reduce the deficit. We had a deficit which was hovered around 7% for 4 years ago, in 2010. And the European Union has a rule that if your deficit is above 3% of GDP and you don't take the measures that they recommend to take after a while, they say that you are under the excessive deficit procedure. And that means that first they give you various recommendations that you have to do, and if you don't do, take those measures, they can introduce sanctions against you. Among the sanctions is suspension of structural grants. The EU gives aid to the poorer countries of the European Union, the so-called structural structural funds. And the government decided that, you know, wants to reduce to the deficit to below 3%. At the same time, it wanted to reduce the taxes also, because it wanted to leave in the hands of the population as much money to spend they could. So it was a combination of reducing expenditures, reducing to some extent reducing taxes, sorry, reducing to some extent also expenditures, and the deficit was at the end reduced to below 3% of the GDP. Many structural measures were also introduced. Many things were changed. The social benefit system was changed. Labor policies were changed. Instead of giving social benefits, they gave work to people, and that also has helped to increase employment. More recently, Hungarian Central Bank has also started to reduce the interest rates and introduced a so-called funding for growth, whereby gives very cheap credit to commercial banks, and commercial banks have to use that for certain type of investment, mostly for small and medium-sized investment. This is to encourage credit loans to that sector, and hopefully, you know, increase growth. On the other hand, it has also taken some measures that are controversial, which is taxing very heavily the commercial banking system, and some of the most profitable industries, like telecommunication, was one of them. So this is why many people call that unorthodox measures. But, you know, basically, in my view, are these measures have, you know, been taken in many other countries. Maybe the mix of this policy could be called unorthodox. And your last question was whether. Oh, within the Eurozone. You know, the members of the European Union have a commitment that they have to enter the Eurozone. There are exceptions. The UK and Denmark are exceptions. But the other members have to enter the Eurozone. But they have to satisfy some requirements. The inflation rate has to be reduced to a certain level, the government deficit has to be below 3% of GDP, the debt has to be 60% or being reduced towards 60%. They have to enter the an exchange rate mechanism. So these are called the Maastricht criteria, because those were decided in a city in the Netherlands that's called Maastricht.
Now, my view is that for small open economies like Hungary or like practically all these countries in Central and Eastern Europe, where trade and the integration of trade and finance and integration of capital markets are so close, so strong, there is an interest to be within the monetary union. However, you can follow good and bad policies within and without the monetary union. If you follow good policies, I think you're better off if you are within the European zone. If you follow bad policies, then it's better if you are outside, both for your own country, a country that follows the bad policies, and for the other members of the European Union. But you cannot have a goal to follow bad policies. So in the end, my conclusion is that it's better to be within the monetary union. Now, because of this crisis that happened in 2008, different countries was exposed to different types of difficulties. So under those circumstances, it gives you more room for maneuver and more possibilities to change the mix of your economic policies if you are outside from the monetary union. So whether to say that it was better or worse for countries within the monetary union, the jury is still out. You have to wait another 5, 6, 7 years to figure out what would have been better.
Hi, my name is Connor Yakaitis. I'm a political science major here. And my question is, to put this in more current perspective, how has the escalating situation in Ukraine impacted the transatlantic trade agreement, as well as the Eurozone and just Hungary in general?
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a very, very topical question. The hope is that, of course, it will not affect the negotiation of the TTIP, both on the side of the United States and on the side of the Europe. You know, people want to go ahead with it. Might make the situation a little bit more complicated is that the United States and Europe decided to introduce economic sanctions. So the first is to freeze the assets of some Russian and Ukrainian government officials or oligarchs and suspend or not to give visa to these people. So this is very mild. But there is the decision is to take in several phases, and phase three would be to take economic sanctions. Now, here, the issue is that Europe is much more the economic and financial relations between Europe and Russia are much more intertwined than it is with the United States. Trade is higher. But again, it depends on country by country. For the United Kingdom, it is most importantly financial relationships. For Germany, oil imports. For France, exports of military equipment. For Central and Eastern Europe, very important, we depend between 70% to 90% on the imports of gas from Russia. So Russia can retaliate with cutting off gas exports to these countries. So it has been decided that if something happens and Russia retaliates, then the solidarity within the European Union has to take place, and countries will help the other countries that are more hit. So the solidarity should enter. But at the same time, the solidarity also means that if there is a decision by the EU to the sanctions, then, you know, everybody would go with it. However, there would be, within the European Union, countries that are suffering more that would be helped by the others. Now, the hope is, of course, that you will not have to go to this third phase of sanctions, and that the political situation can be resolved by negotiations. Yes?
Good morning. My name is Ben Sakirai. You were talking about the Central European countries, that they are really depending on Russia in the gas situation. I know the Visegrad countries had negotiations with the U.S. about U.S. exporting gas to Europe. Do you think that this free trade agreement could start a significant export of gas to Europe and giving the Visegrad countries a kind of energy security?
Yes, at our initiative, the Hungarian Embassy's initiative, we have written a letter, the four Visegrad countries' ambassadors have written a letter to Boehner and Reid, to the Senate and to the Chamber, ask for support the Congress for U.S. LNG exports to Europe. Because right now, for countries that are not members of the free trade agreement between the United States, exports are very, very difficult to obtain export licenses. We would like to have support from the Congress to allow LNG exports to Europe. Now, obviously, it will take some time because you have to build the LNG terminals here also in the United States, or convert within the United States, because there are LNG imports in the United States. You can convert those facilities more easily than to build a new one. But also in Europe, you have to build, for instance, Croatia. It would be very good if they had an LNG import facility so that it could provide gas to Central and Eastern Europe. So even though it would take some time, you have to start doing it. That would also hopefully encourage Russia not to cut gas supplies to Central and Eastern Europe, or to Europe generally.
Ambassador, my name is Steve Bannister. I'm in the economics department here. Some economists, macroeconomists or international economists, believe that the Eurozone, the performance of the Eurozone, could be improved by moving more toward a fiscal and perhaps political union, as opposed to just almost purely a monetary union, as it is now. Do you have a view on the path of those ideas in the EU, and whether it would be more attractive then for countries such as Hungary to join? Thank you.
Well, of course, that's a big debate, that you have a monetary union, but you don't have a common fiscal policy. And that it's very difficult to have a monetary union when the fiscal policies are not coordinated enough. So the way Europe is trying to reduce that, to mitigate this problem, is to have a rule-based fiscal policy whereby, you know, your debt cannot be more than 60%, your deficit has to be less than 3%, and that has even been tightened. The rules have been a little bit tightened over the past few years. Of course, this is the second best solution. But to have a common fiscal policy, you need practically a common, you need a much bigger political union which can decide on what the fiscal policy will be on taxes, on expenditures, etc. And this is very difficult because countries are historically have been, you know, independent, have had their own parliaments and their own fiscal policies, and surrendering prerogatives, very few countries are ready to do that. So I think in the future, the foreseeable future, let me put it that way, the Eurozone would remain, that's I believe, and it would be based on rule-based fiscal policy with maybe better monitoring, better enforcement for those who are not following those rules, and little by little giving a little bit more power to the European Parliament. And, you know, it will be building in that direction. So it will take time. So before it becomes an aircraft career, that would take a little bit more time. It's one captain.
Hi, my name's Josh Greep again. Just one more question. As you were presenting the rise in public debt and the decrease in private debt, could you just go into that a little bit more? I feel like I don't quite understand the correlation there, and what's the relationship between the two?
When people overborrowed and could not pay back the banks, many banks had problems. The situation got more complicated that in the United States, the mortgage companies, typically they give, there are relatively thousands of mortgage companies, mortgage banks. They then passed on these mortgages to bigger banks, big investment banks. They put it together in a package and gave it rating agencies gave them a very high rating, AAA even sometimes, and because they were fetching a little bit of higher interest rates in a very low interest rates environment, they started to spread that around to other banks, to other investment banks. And then when it turned out that people who overborrowed, they couldn't pay their debt, then suddenly this mortgage credit or mortgage loans within that package became dubious. But there were thousands of loan agreements in there that as a result, because you didn't know how much it was worth, as a result it became worthless, zero. And many banks who had large amounts of those, investment banks, had to write this off. By writing this off, they had a big loss, so big that some of the companies went bankrupt and Lehman Brothers was led to go bankrupt because it reverberated in other things also. You know, the interbank market where, you know, one bank gives a credit to another overnight, etc., froze because you didn't know whether this bank, how solvent it is, can it pay? So it froze. And so it escalated into this debt crisis or financial crisis, let's put it this way first. And then the state had to come in, the governments had to come in to help them, because if the whole system collapses, it would have been much, much worse, the situation. Because so what they did was they bailed in the banks. They bought their shares. They gave them money. In some countries, in the UK, they had to take over the entire bank. That means that expenditures increased. Taxpayers' money was spent to bail out the banks, to save the financial system. And as a result of that, government debt increased. And now, once that happened, and sort of the financial system was more or less stabilized, started to take measures to reduce the deficit, which then meant either to increase taxes or to reduce expenditure or a mixture of the two, which meant that which meant that the fiscal policy became contractionary. The fiscal policy becoming contractionary, it negatively affects domestic demand. But at the same time, the households were also deleveraging because they had very high debt, overborrowed, and those who could afford because they worked, etc., they wanted to reduce the debt as much as they could. Now, that process has been the most successful in the United States. Household debt is back where it was roughly, where it was back prior to the crisis. And although the debt is, government debt is very high, the United States is in the unique position that it can finance relatively high debt because the rest of the world is financing, buying government treasury bonds and bills because it's sort of a safe haven for the world. But countries like Hungary or Germany alone or France cannot do that. They do have to reduce the deficit. So therefore, their contractionary policies were much more pronounced than in the United States. But as you know, in the United States, there's a big discussion of how big the deficit should be, how fast the debt should be reduced. You know, it's a big discussion here as well. So this is one reason why the United States is also in better position is because the financial sector is stronger. Many, if not all, the banks that were bailed out by the government have paid back the government, which is not the case in Europe.
Please join me in thanking Ambassador Sigari for an excellent informative forum.
Thank you.